Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray, and joining me this week in the editorial lounge to discuss the news are Adam McQueen, Helen Lewis and Jane McKenzie. Later on in the show, we're also going to be talking about the UK's water situation. Water everywhere, and all of it's horrible because it's got sewage floating in it. We'll be talking to Sarah Shannon and Solomon Hughes about that. But firstly, back to the, I think editorial lounge might be the way to go with this. I mean,
makes it sound like we're going to do some live freeform jazz at some point, but
should I cross that off the the agenda? Okay. So first of all, I suppose we should talk about a story that was enormous in the news last week, has faded away a bit since then. The story about the mystery BBC presenter who was alleged to have been doing all sorts of, how do they call it, awful but lawful, and possibly unlawful too in some cases, sexual misconduct. There was a big old search for who it might be, and lots and lots and lots of very inaccurate speculation before eventually it was revealed that the presenter in question was Hugh Edwards. So, Adam, you wrote a bit about this story, didn't you?
We did. It was a slight scramble at the last moment on a press day on Monday morning to try and cobble something together in one of those cases of absolutely appalling time. Probably the worst case of timing since Theresa May decided to use the Tuesday after we'd gone to press to call a general election in 2017. But we did manage to kind of slightly be across that story, and there will be more to come, I hope, on that story in the issue coming up as well.
It was a very odd story in that I think it worked out quite well for the Sun in the end that they hadn't named him, right? And that you might have thought they'd done that for legal reasons. I'm still not entirely clear what was going on there. But actually, it reminded me a lot of the fact there's been a big wave of true crime, massive in podcasts, right? And then actually has now kind of infected the internet. The first time I remember this happening was on Reddit with the search for the Boston bomber, and this Reddit community got the idea this guy had done it, and it turned out it was a poor guy chucked himself into the river, but they ruined, you know, bulldozed his life. Same thing happened with the woman who fell into the river, and people were turning up at the village, you know, and people just get this idea that everybody's on the hunt together. And I think that's how I felt with Hugh Edwards, right? It just, the story became more and more sort of smelt of blood as the week went on.
Well, it was extraordinary. I mean, it was incredible. It was a bit like that wave of super injunctions that we talked about on the last podcast in 2011, where people were being identified as a Premier League footballer, which immediately put every Premier League footballer under suspicion, and all sorts of people. Do you remember Gabby Logan had to deny having an affair with Alan Shearer at some point, and neither of them being involved in anything at all? And it was a bit like this at all. I mean, because immediately before Hugh Edwards' name came out there, all sorts of other BBC presenters were being forced to issue denials and in some cases legal threats. There was a very, very interesting tweet today, wasn't there, Helen? You showed me, from someone who had decided to name Jeremy Vine very definitively as the suspect.
I know this is a personal gripe, and I'm sure maybe you all share it, but you're too good to say it out loud. But people who think that they're journalists on the internet, and they go, I don't see why all these journalists are being so cowardly. I'm a true-born Englishman. You can't get me saying, it's obviously Jeremy Vine. I won't back down. And then cut to presumably a very stern lawyer's letter later of, I regret that I made such insinuations about Jeremy Vine, whom I now accept is right, close to Jesus.
Isn't part of the problem then not naming the person in the first place? You just say there is a huge story about a senior BBC presenter. That's obviously going to lead to wild speculation.
It ties into this whole citizen journalism of people on the internet thing. But what the topic really is just stories that aren't true, and that's why the mainstream media aren't reporting them, because you endlessly, I mean, a bit like on the last one we said, you know, anyone who tells you the reason this isn't being reported is because there's a super injunction. Basically, anyone who tells you the mainstream media aren't reporting this, there are two possible interpretations of this. One of them is that the mainstream media usually are reporting it, it's just that you haven't noticed. And the other one is that the mainstream media have spent a bit of time looking into it and discovered that it just isn't true, however much you would like it to be true.
For a while, we had this situation with circular sourcing on Wikipedia, where Wikipedia would reference a story from one newspaper report, and then everybody would rely on Wikipedia as a definitive, this must be true, it's in an encyclopedia, for the next newspaper report, and it just went round and round as becoming more and more true, even though it was based on one somewhat obscure story in the first place.
Yes, and there was a related problem with that, which is that Wikipedia would source incorrect, like on your page, it could source to third-party sources stuff that they claimed you had said or thought, and you weren't a reliable source, a first-person source to go, but I don't think that, I haven't said that.
Oh yes, the one person who's not allowed to edit a Wikipedia entry is the person it's about.
Which was kind of sensible, but it was also like, but I didn't do it. Anyway, that's my. This isn't Helen's grievance hour, Andy. Okay.
But there is still this thing. I mean, the, in terms of Jane, you're the full time reporter here at Private Eye. I'm not sure we get hundreds, if not thousands, of tip offs from people every week. I mean, of the proportion, I mean, very few of them turn out just to be complete and utter bollocks, to use the legal term. But how many of them do you think in the end turn out to be something even approaching a story?
Of 100 sort of tip-offs that come from just out there, rather than sort of contacts or sort of ongoing sources, I'd say between 5 and 10 are mischievous lies. Up to 50 are from people who've got the wrong end of the stick and are well-intentionedly trying to tell us something that they're completely wrong about.
Okay. There's about 40, 45 left.
So we're halfway through already. Maybe 20 of those are true, but have actually already been sort of well-reported elsewhere, and they're doing that kind of, no one in the mainstream media has covered this. And you Google it, and everyone in the mainstream media has covered this. And then you've got a bunch that are true, but... Well, they're possibly a true tip-off about their next-door neighbour where they're very cross about their hedge.
Right.
Which, you know, it's you could stand it up if you wanted to, but possibly the readers aren't going to be that excited by. So you're sort of down to around 10, which are worth pursuing as stories. And of those, you get down to kind of 2 or 3 that properly stand up.
Actually, this brings us around circularly to the Hugh Edwards story again, because one of the things that actually rather impressed me in this was the fact that one of the things we have established is that the initial complaint was made by a member of the young person's family turning up at the front desk of a BBC office and saying that all this had been going on. And I was trying to imagine, I was just thinking, judging by the sort of... contacts we get from members of the public here, I was thinking, how many people must turn up at BBC offices making various claims about presenters on the telly being either their mistress or their love child or all sorts of things. It actually seemed to me that the BBC had actioned that one quite quickly and must be kind of thanking their lucky stars that they did in that case. They went on to the corporate investigations team, I think, within 24 hours of it.
Right.
But that speaks to something that, Jane, I'm sure you've had to do, which is that you sometimes have to ask yourself of a source, why are they talking to me?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
It's not like everybody approaches journalists with a pure desire purely for the truth to be had out. And I think that the Sun story is a very good example of that, right? It wasn't the young person, it was the young person's parents. And then the young person himself came out and said, it's rubbish. And that does really change how you see the story when that comes to you like that.
Absolutely. I mean, there's all kinds of motivations for people coming to tell you things. And it's not actually that common that it's just purely get the truth out. It's quite often motivated by sort of personal animus and malice against somebody involved in the story.
I should think so too. We cut out all stories without any personal animus or malice involved. We're going to have a 4-page magazine.
I think one of the real misfortunes suffered by the BBC last week was that they ended up having two of the institutions in the country who most dislike and are most motivated by wanting to expose wrongdoing by the BBC lined up against them, which are, of course, The Sun and the BBC, because there is nothing that BBC journalists like more, as you say, reporting on what's going on in their own corporation and also things that might make their managers look bad as well.
Helen, you wanted to talk a bit more about the by-elections that are happening at the time of broadcast tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
See, that is your podcasting experience, Andy. That is beautiful to see in action. Yeah, there are three. So there is Selby and Ainsty, Somerton and Froome, and Uxbridge and South Ruislip. There ought to be another one, technically, by Nadine Dorries' seat of Mid-Bedfordshire, only, of course, she still hasn't got round to
She's
resigning.
Schrodinger's MP, isn't she? Has she resigned? Has she not resigned? Who knows?
She has, however, which I'm very excited about. I will return to on this podcast. Had time to write a memoir. I mean, it's going to have some fictional elements in that all of the MPs are going to have James Bond pseudonyms. Did you read this bit of it?
I missed this.
Yeah, so it's going to be like, I'll tell you why I hate Ernst Blofeld. And then it's obviously going to be a description of, you know, David Cameron or someone.
Fantastic.
Wow.
Yeah. So I'm lobbying already for us to do a dramatic reading of that when it comes out in the autumn. But what's interesting about these is I think that they're all Tory seats and they're all expected to go. And actually, if the Tories manage to retain any of them, that will be a kind of sad little fillip in their, you know, wind in their sails. But in the southwest, you know, the Lib Dems have traditionally been very strong, so they could well take that one. And then the other two are, you know, really open to being taken by Labour. Uxbridge is only about a 7,000 majority, but in Selby and Ainsty, it's over 20,000. Mm-hmm. And it is what everyone would kind of want to shoot themselves in the head was calling a red wall seat, in the sense it was 59% voted Brexit. So that is exactly the type of seat that Labour needs to retake in order to win the next election. But the one of the really interesting things about Uxbridge that I saw come out from the Sunday Times' Tom Calver this weekend is that there was polling which showed that Labour is ahead on every single issue, even the ones you wouldn't necessarily expect them to be strong on, so crime and immigration, everything except ULEZ, which is the ultra-low emission zone, which is now associated with Sadiq Khan, London mayor, but was in fact brought in by Boris Johnson, London mayor. Except, though, Adam, tell
he
me
devoted.
About...
He devoted. Yeah, I mean, this is kind of Boris Johnson column watch, isn't it? We read Boris Johnson's mail column, so you don't have to on this podcast. But yes, he devoted his column a couple of Saturdays ago to what a terrible thing ULEZ was and what a regressive and appalling idea it was to extend it over London. But essentially saying the whole thing was an awful idea, omitting to mention that it was an idea that was had and brought in under the previous London mayor, Mr. Boris Johnson. So yeah. Sticking to form there.
And apparently he's had one call with the Tory candidate in which he basically said, "Don't you think my column was rather good?" And the guy said, "Yeah, that was all right." And he's like, "Well, that's great. I hope you're getting on well." And then put the phone down. Hasn't been able to canvass for him. But I just respect that. But Andy, I think you're really interested in green issues. I'm interested. It seems to me there is a problem that people generally are actually rating climate higher and higher in their list of priorities.
Yeah, it's always a top five thing. And Boris himself was seen as a climate relatively active on climate matters, you know. He wanted Britain to be the Saudi Arabia of offshore wind, and
well, he's flipped and flopped on it, hasn't he? In the way that he does. And when he was a Telegraph columnist, he used to poo-poo anything green and say, you know, wind turbines are terrible.
Yeah.
Then when he was the lovely Liberal London mayor who went to Pride marches, he was very, very keen on kind of green issues.
And his
he's
most recent
turned around a bit, hasn't he?
Particularly
Heathrow, of course,
Heathrow.
He was going to lie in front of the bulldozers,
indeed,
wasn't he? Instead, he just chose to lie in front of everyone else.
What I think is interesting for politics going forward is the fact that although people are kind of on board with the idea that the world is slightly crisping, you know, we're writing this when there's a huge heat dome all over, quite a lot of the US and also Southern Europe is going up to the mid-40s. But every single policy you propose against it is actually polls quite badly. Maybe not every single one, but quite a lot of them.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? There is a wide perception that wind farms onshore are very unpopular. And they're actually not that unpopular. I mean, it's 75 or 80% of people who say, yeah, I'd be okay with one near me, especially if my community gets a bit of the financial benefit or lower energy bills. So yeah, there is a perception that any action is going to be very unpopular. It's partly also because you might live near a solar farm or a wind farm. You probably don't live next to an oil rig or an open cast coal mine. Although, Jane, I know we've spoken about the people who do live near an open cast coal mine quite recently.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Yes. Which was continuing to run even though it was not licensed to extract coal anymore.
One thing I wanted to ask you, Jane, is how many of the opposition, local bits of local opposition, I think you cover quite a lot, to solar farms or to, you know, or like people invoking nature reserves to not build houses, how much of that is genuine? I realise I'm inviting you to make yourself very unpopular with a lot of people who are going to be furious if you say some of them aren't, but please go ahead.
Oh, NIMBYism in terms of we don't want this development right near us can definitely be very grassroots. It's a genuine response from people, quite often because a huge housing development can arrive and there's still no effort to improve the local NHS. So in fact, it's true that your problems accessing a GP and so forth are going to get worse. That's the problem with that, is that government isn't happening and something isn't being done to ensure that big development doesn't really badly affect communities. So, yes, I think a lot of that does come from a genuine grassroots opposition. But then it's quite easy for bodies that want that particular opposition to be very visible to help out with that. I think local grassroots campaigns can find that they get a surprising amount of funding and support from organisations that want, for instance, solar not to be developed on that scale or in that area.
Yeah, I think there was Robbie Culver's Sunday Times column talked about the fact that there were some woods, basically, that there had been a big order to be no more houses built around them in case the problem being that too many people are going to go into the woods.
What's in the woods? My God!
But the problem, also one of the things being that this survey was conducted during COVID times, in which there wasn't really a lot to do in the local area except go into the woods and a healthy ramble.
And did anyone get eaten by a monster?
The MSM media doesn't report on that, Adam.
Of course they don't. Of course they don't.
It's another cover-up.
The Conservatives seem to really have themselves in knots over climate stuff. If they passed the net zero legislation, you know, they're the ones who kind of committed themselves to this and committed the country to it in, what, 2019. It was the Theresa May thing. So you would presume there's an opportunity for a bit of solar nationalism here, you know.
And yet Liz Truss managed to win substantial support for her leadership campaign by being opposed to solar in farmland.
Is that pitching to the membership as opposed to pitching to the country? Yeah.
There is a very specific demographic there.
Yeah, because you get various Conservatives who are quite, you know, hawkish or active on climate, like Chris Skidmore and so on. And you would think there would be a really strong case to say, look, we can free ourselves from dependency on importing 60% of our gas. You know, we can free ourselves from dependency on foreign gas, and we have enough good, honest British sunshine hitting these shores that we can completely make ourselves independent. But that case isn't being made, and I wonder if that's another membership thing. Not that Rishi Sunak is very popular with the membership.
I also wonder if it's an importation of US culture wars, where energy is such a big thing. You know, Joe Manchin in West Virginia with a senator. It's just that is the kind of ultimate swing state is about coal producing. And so I think there is a kind of lack of imagination that if you're a proper right winger, then you think all this green stuff is nonsense, right? And David Cameron obviously tried to break that. The trouble is there are lots of things you could do that would be weird and interesting. Jeremy Hunt, the Chancellor, has got this mad plan that he wants 5% of pension funds by default invested into startups, which I think is a bad
British startup.
British startup, yeah. Specifically, which is a bad idea because all of those track very badly and actually would probably lose a lot of money. But it essentially is a way of stealthily funding British startups. Now, I think there's a way of tweaking that. So if you made that clean energy startups, for example, like this is something, you know, we have a lot of coastline. We could be a huge exporter of energy. There are things that we could do. This is the technology that will define the next 50 years. And I think, Andy, it's just a lack of imagination. It's but we've always done politics. Green stuff's really unpopular. Mm. Not thinking to make hard-headed economic arguments about it, apart from anything else.
There is a kind of sense of knackeredness about lots of infrastructure at the moment. And Jane, you write a lot about this, don't you?
Yes, and in terms of knackered infrastructure, we're looking at a really worrying situation with our public buildings at the moment. A lot of them are very knackered, and not just in terms of the general wear and tear that we can probably all see in various public buildings, but it's becoming increasingly clear that schools and hospitals and possibly court buildings and prisons and so on, the materials that we used to build them in the 60s to 80s had a very, very limited life. And in particular, a material called reinforced autoclaved aerated concrete. So it's that lightweight bubbly concrete.
Okay.
Suddenly falls apart with very little warning, which has happened already to two primary schools.
Oh my God.
What happened exactly? The roof cave in? Because it's sort of the one thing you want a primary school not to do is collapse on your children.
Absolutely. We've been exceptionally lucky that these both happened when the kids were not in the classroom. Mm-hmm. But it goes with very, very little warning. And the Department for Education have been doing a survey to find out how many buildings are in this state. And they've closed 24 schools in the last couple of months, because they were in imminent danger of falling down.
I was going to say, help me calibrate my worryometer on this, because it does, when you're talking like that, it sounds a bit reminiscent of the cladding disaster, right? Which people warned about for a very long time, and everyone had this vague sense of like, oh, there is this flammable cladding, is this really the safety standards? And then it took Grenfell for everybody to go, there's a big problem. It's still not a problem that's solved, but where should I be on my worryometer?
It's high. I mean, genuinely, they're saying critical, very high. Is what the DfE's own risk register describes the situation as. The NHS has identified 7 hospital trusts that the roofs are principally built from this material, and the Ministry of Justice is refusing to say how much of its estate is
That's
built
That's never
from
a
it.
Good sign, is it? No.
But if you think how much of the Ministry of Justice estate, so that's the court buildings and the prisons, were built in the 60s to 80s, that's when this material was in use.
Wow. It's funny, isn't it? Because there's a sort of assumption that progress is always going forward and that modern building materials must be better than what they used in the old days. But I mean, that was with the cladding, with the aerated concrete that you're talking about. But also you've been in your with your hat on as Nooks and Corners correspondent, you've been talking about glass buildings as well and problems with those, haven't you?
That's right.
And they're from even later. They're from the 1990s, am I right?
So we recently covered the situation at the National Glass Centre in Sunderland. where the so that was 1990s. It was one of the first National Lottery funded builds, and it has a sort of spectacular glass roof, which is unfortunately failing. And it was problematic from the start, but it's now reached the end of its survivable life.
When you say failing in relation to a glass roof, is that individual panes just giving up?
At the moment, the situation is largely that it lets water in.
Okay.
Rather like the roof at Portcullis House,
which let
a lot of water in last week.
That's more recently. But, oh no, maybe similar. That was 90s, wasn't it? Yeah.
Tragically, I can actually remember doing number crunches in Private Eye about the cost of Portcullis House. And specifically, I think it was the olive trees that they had specially imported and planted in the atrium, which are now presumably being fantastically well watered because the water's coming in through the roof. But I mean, this is, I mean, I know I'm on a bit of an old git, but this is, you know, this is very recent memory for a lot of listeners, wouldn't it? I mean, things should generally be expected to have a life of more than 20, 30 years, should they not? Would you not expect?
Arup, the engineering firm, have been doing work on the Burrell collection in Glasgow to restore their glass wall. And they did a report on the life expectancy of glass curtain walls, which is about 25 years. Not because of the glass itself doesn't fail, but the sealants that they were using in the late 20th century just have a 25-year life expectancy.
Which I presume we're finding out about now.
If you had a glass curtain wall built with a mortgage, just as you finished paying for it, it would all fall apart.
Okay. Is there any sense of who's liable for this anymore? I mean, it's a long time since they were constructed.
I think they'll have a job going back to the original building designers and material suppliers. It's been a longer time scale than, for instance, the cladding scandal, where you can kind of go after the people who designed or sold it.
And presumably we're also getting into a period where a lot of these things would have been built under PFI and contracts sold on, which is something that I wrote about endlessly over decades, isn't it? It all gets very, very complicated.
And particularly with the glass wall buildings, because they were very fashionable in the late 90s, big glass atrium walls.
Yeah. At this point, I'm feeling much, much happier about the fact that this place has just not been tidied up since the 1990s. The fact we're actually seeing in what should be a reasonably score 18th century Soho townhouse.
There's a lot of the piles of paper that actually do the structural underpinning in this building, though. So that's the... But then they're never touched, so that's
yeah, fine. Yeah, no, as long as you don't move anything,
yeah,
that's
exactly,
fine.
Yeah.
So we wrote about this issue about a year ago, about... sort of schools were starting to become awake to this issue with the RAC concrete. And since then, the National Audit Office has had a really good look at the issue. And it's them who've identified how many schools there are that are facing this problem.
Right.
And the sort of scale of the problem.
You shouldn't be allowed to call concrete reinforced if it's actually worse than normal concrete. Would be my position.
Trace description is the
reinforced with little bubbles of air.
Jane McKenzie there. Thanks to her, Adam and Helen for their contributions. Now, we come to a story which we've covered a little bit on page 94 in the past, the story of privatised water. You might have seen in the headlines that Thames Water is facing the prospect of going into administration, and that is not the only water company in the UK that is, failing to deliver some of the lovely clean water that you might expect from firms which are very profitable. Lots of the Eyes writers have been covering this in their own different ways. I've been speaking to Sarah Shannon, who'll be along in a bit. But first, Solomon Hughes has an exciting new award for the water industry. It's the Private Eye Turd of the Week Award. It's obviously an extremely poor, some would say indefensibly poor taste. I started off by asking Solomon exactly how he could justify this really disgraceful lowering of the tone in the magazine. He, in the proudest Private Eye tradition, shunted the blame upwards. Here's Solomon.
It doesn't start with my thinking, it starts with our editor Ian Hislop's thinking, and I have to say this is the second time, I've been a journalist for maybe 30, 35 years, and this is the second time where the sub-editor has put profanity into my writing rather than taking it out. Normally you would just say, oh, this is all bollocks, and you'd expect the sub-editor to change it to, this is a questionable behaviour or something like that. But in this case, the piece I submitted, I went for a discharge of the week, and it's Ian that has changed it to turd. I prefer discharge because discharge is the formal term used by the Environment Agency. They say, We're finding Anglian water, this is an older story, at 2.65 million after a sewage discharged into the North Sea. They don't say turds flowed into the sea, but Ian preferred that.
Well, this is absolutely horrible already, so let's dive in. Let's put our goggles on. Who is the inaugural Private Eye Turd of the Week?
I can reveal, and I'm proud to say this, that the Turd of the Week is Anglian Water Chief Executive Peter Simpson.
Congratulations, Mr. Simpson, if you're listening. I know you do. And Solomon, what has Mr. Simpson won this award for?
Well, Peter's company were fined at the end of June £150,000 for discharging sewage into Bedfordshire's delightful River Till. His contractors, they were trying to unblock a sewer with water jets, and they managed to overwhelm the treatment centre, leading to a spillage of sewage. It's just a little spill, but it's a recent spill. But we thought it was the extra effort that he'd managed to do this recently, or his company managed to do this recently, because if you just looked back a little bit, in January they fined £500,000 for fish killing, a fish killing discharge in Northamptonshire, and in 2022 you go back then and you'll find millions and millions of pounds of fines. So his reward was for his latest achievement, but it did recognise previous achievements as well.
That's not all, is there? Because there was a runner-up this week, and the runner-up was also a previous executive from Anglian Water.
That's right. Sir Adrian Montagu has just been put in charge of Thames Water, which is really, really in trouble. We know Thames Water are in trouble because they've got that pattern which you find throughout the water industry of a privatised company that's paid off loads of dividends but left the water infrastructure really shaky. So they've been in trouble. I mean, you know, really teetering on the edge of collapse. So they brought in a safe pair of hands. So they brought in Sir Adrian Montagu, who's often featured in Private Eye, not least because he was on the board of Anglian between 2010 and 2015, when the investors there were squeezing out cash from the firm and really not investing as much as they should in the infrastructure. So it's like Anglian Water has given us as two really leading important figures in the turd business. And we can all feel pleased about that.
And those figures are really striking, in fact, because it's worth saying the basic flow of money, just reiterating for our listeners, the basic flow of money is the company makes profits because they're private companies. They make money from the people who use the water that they provide. And those profits often go to shareholders. So the figure that we quoted in the piece, in the 5 years to March 2014, the pre-tax profits for Anglian Water were £1.65 billion. And of that, slightly more than 100%, £1.7 billion was paid out to shareholders. So that leaves absolutely nothing to invest in the actual infrastructure, the actual pipes, the actual stations, the actual water itself.
Well, I mean, nothing from the profit. I mean, obviously, there's just the kind of the generality of the money, the turnover they're taking in. You'd hope that they bought a washer or two, or put in a bit.
Fingers
of,
crossed.
A bit of concrete for a culvert or what have you. But all the extra money, isn't it? All the profit is just, it's like a smash and grab raid.
Solomon Hughes there. So those are the winners and the runner-up of the inaugural Turd of the Week, but we do have another story about water in the latest edition of the magazine, and it's from a bit further north than Anglia Water's brief. This is all about Yorkshire Water, and Sarah Shannon wrote about them. Sarah, you wrote about a small village called Bishop Monkton in North Yorkshire. Can you tell us what your story was, please?
Yes, I can. Yes, it's a lovely village in North Yorkshire. It's close to Ripon. About 750 people live there. It's a pretty village, but it's got one ugly issue, which is that sewage, when there's heavy rainfall in the village, sewage kind of rises up through manhole covers and flows through the village's streets. A villager sent me a photograph of May this year. It was coronation time and they had all their Union Jack bunting hanging out along the street. It looked so nice. But then beneath the bunting was the not so pretty sight of this foul water flowing along the streets. So this has been a real issue for a number of years, and it doesn't seem to be getting any better, and the villagers are very understandably upset about it.
And yet there is a proposal for a new housing development, which it sounds like might make matters worse.
Well, yes. So basically, there are three different housing development proposals. If they all went through, they'd make the village about 40% bigger. So the villagers just thought, well, that's never going to get through because, you know, our wastewater system is creaky. It's part Victorian. It can't cope with our waste. They're never going to allow a development for 40% more housing in this village. But to their shock and horror, Yorkshire Water said that it was absolutely fine to go ahead with the development. So North Yorkshire planning officers recommended that it went ahead to the council.
Why would Yorkshire Water claim that it was all right to go ahead if they know the situation on the ground already?
Well, that's the extraordinary thing. And when I asked them that, and also when the villagers obviously asked them that, they said that they're not actually a statutory consultee on the development. So the only criteria they had for it going ahead is that the housing would be able to separate the surface water from foul water. And it can do that, the piping system. The fact that sewage overflows up through manhole covers and onto the village street wasn't sort of thought to be worth the mention, as long as, you know, this kind of narrow requirement was fulfilled. But obviously, 40% bigger village means 40% more sewage. And I think the poor villagers are imagining a kind of tidal wave of crap coming through their village, and were very, very understandably unhappy at this idea.
So what happened next?
Well, what happened next was the planning officers took it to North Yorkshire Council, well, to the planning committee for that area, Skipton and Ripon. And the councillors listened to the villagers. One of the councillors lives in that patch. And understandably, they saw sense and said, well, what on earth are you thinking? We can't add to a village that can't cope with the sewage that it's got. I mean, last year, apparently, 338 hours of sewage water, or discharge before treatment, as they call it, went into the Bishop Monckton overflow, which basically goes into this pretty little beck that runs through their village and then goes onwards from there into the River Ure. So the councillors saw sense, said no more development, not until Yorkshire Water has come up with a plan for resolving the sewage issues that they already have.
That's extraordinary. Well, that sounds like a victory for the eye, I'm going to say.
I don't know. No, I think
maybe
it's a
not.
Victory for the villagers who had campaigned for a long time about this. And also the councillor in their area had raised a lot of other issues in other villages on his patch. He'd done a little survey and found out that half of all the villages in his area have issues with sewage overflowing into their streets. So I mean, as one Bishop Monckton villager said to us, you know, this shouldn't be happening in the 21st century, you know. But Yorkshire Water just say that, you know, that development criteria isn't their issue, and they answer, you know, what they need to. And on a Zoom call with the villagers, they said, you know, the villagers said, well, can you please tell the council that you shouldn't go ahead because you can't cope with the sewage that we've got? And Yorkshire Water said, no, we won't be telling them that. You can if you'd like to, but that's not our role. So, yeah, it's like madness. But the councillors themselves saw sense, and in fact, they were vaguely cynical about it, healthily cynical, I think the eye would say. They said, well, you know, I guess for Yorkshire Water, all it means is more customers on their roster, and, you know, the sewage issue, they can kick that down the road. But one positive thing Yorkshire Water did say to the people when they got in contact was that they are due an upgrade to their sewage system. So they got quite excited and said, when is this going to be? And they said, well, it's going to be sometime during our next 25-year cycle. So I don't think that raised huge amounts of glee in Bishop Monckton.
That's it for this episode of Page 94. We'll be back again in a fortnight with another one. Until then, just remain calm and keep buying Private Eye. Thanks for listening. This episode, as always, was produced by Matt Hill of Rethink Audio. Bye for now.